We're live! Jimmy D and the Wolf podcast.
What's up, my friend?
Well, just going through the, playing through the changes of life.
I hear you, man. I hear you. It was a beautiful, beautiful day in Madison today. You can smell spring in the air. It's coming. There's just a general sense of optimism across the board. I'm excited. Music coming back. I was thinking about it today. It's like, I hope all my stuff works. You know, when I start doing a gazillion gigs a week and stuff like I was, there's so many amps I haven't used for a while and guitars I haven't used for a while. I hope they still work and I hope I still work. I hope I can still play.
Well, I'm sure that won't be a problem. You've been doing for 20, 25 years.
So. We'll see, man. I think everybody's going to be a little bit rusty. It just is what it is. Because to do it, you know, you got to do it all the time. You really have to. And it's not the same without a crowd. You know, you don't get that energy, that kind of symbiotic thing. Give and take. I've been trying to force myself to do that lately because I'm afraid, like, I start gigging all the time again, I won't have my chops like I did. So I've been trying to get back on the horse, but it's tough, man. I can't sit there and force myself to play for hours on end when there's nobody else around. Some guys can do that, just woodshed. I don't have that, man. I don't have that thing that where I can just repetitiously play a part over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Well, there had to have been a time when you were like that.
Yeah, sure. All the way up until I became a father of three and got tired. I think it was always that way up until that point.
Become a father of three and get tired.
Yeah, pretty much, man. Well, you always have a window of a couple of years where you don't really sleep right. You know, you're afraid your kid's gonna like fly out of a window or something. So you always just, you know, high alert. I'm still healing up from that. The toddler stage. So still catching up on rest from that.
Well, a deep dive subject. I saw a deep dive by some thoughtful think tank people analyzing the Republican Party and where it's going now that President Trump isn't in office. And there seems to be a lot of infighting and analyzing where it's gone from where it was and trying to analyze, you know, could be a topic or maybe you want to touch that. I don't know.
No, Nim was just asking me something. I noticed today, it's funny that you bring that up because, as you know, I walk every day.
Yes.
And I'm a walk today. I'm in Southern Indiana. It's like, Trump signs everywhere, man, still. And I had the thought today, it was like, how long are those going to be there, man? It's like, are they going to be there for another couple of years?
Well, he's definitely still a force. But it seems like this analysis was saying that, well, even most recently, there's some infighting going on. I think that's pretty obvious to say as an observer. I mean, just the last few days, he sent a letter to the three most powerful organizations. I mean, the Republican Party and I don't remember. There were three organizations that he sent letters saying to cease and desist from using his likeness and his name for fundraising. And apparently, at least the Republican Party is going to say, We're going to ignore that because he's a public figure. And the example given was they often use Nancy Pelosi's name for fundraising, you know, as a I guess, a negative motivator, if you'd say. And there's nothing she can do about the Republican Party using her name. So there's nothing along those same lines of logic. There's nothing that Donald Trump can say to keep the Republican Party from using his name. So it's, but it's interesting that it's definitely infighting, and could it split the party? I mean, there are those who are still quite loyal to Donald Trump, even though he's no longer president. And there are some who are not and wanting to go past. It seems like your neighbor, Mitch McConnell, your neighbor meaning from Kentucky, seems to have moved to the point where he wants to be, he wants the party to move past Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, I think Mitch is going to do what he feels like adds longevity to his career.
Which is interesting. Isn't he in his late 80s now?
Yeah, that dude's been in there for literally as long as I can remember.
You know, or is it, he's in his 80s, whether it's late 80s or early 80s, I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's just been there at the beginning of time.
So was this article was so interesting because it was analyzing, you know, what are the currents, because the Republican Party has changed, certainly from the party of the 90s, you know, and they were talking about populism. It's become more populistic and more nationalistic. And what's the definitions of those two things? So, you know, populism is a movement of basically going against what is perceived to be the elite, whoever the elite are. And that's what populism is considered to be. And so fighting against the elite. And it doesn't have to be right or left. It doesn't have to be right wing. Populism can be actually cuts across a different grain, cuts across a different angle. I mean, you can have... You can have leftist populists and you can have rightist populists from the other types of things, just going against the elite. I mean, there, that's why there are a lot of similarities between the followers of in 2016 between Bernie and Trump. I mean, their policies.
Right. And it's fascinating because lots of uneducated voters feel like the Democratic Party is the populist parties, and lots of uneducated voters feel like the Republican Party is the populist parties. You have that in droves on both sides, where they're saying the other guy is with the bad guys or the elite, the elitist, the rich people.
Right, right. And so, you know, by that definition, populists are going against what are perceived as the elite. So that could be, that could be, you know, that could be AOC, you know, socialists could be saying we're going to tear down the elite. And it could be also, you know, the followers of Trump. So, you know, that's a different slice. That's going across a different cut and a different angle, so to speak. If it's a different way of looking at it, it's really not right or left. It's really the small guy versus the big guy, perception wise. And then each one can describe, define what is the, who is the big guy or the, you know, the elite, you know. So each one may define the elite differently. Obviously, if it's, you know, if it's both Republicans, if our Republicans, right-wing Republicans, extreme right-wings are populist and then socialists are populist, they obviously are describing the elite as in different ways, right? Because they both think the other one is the populist. And then the nationalist sentiment is a little different thing. Nationalist sentiment is more, pops up whenever the perception is that there's a threat to a national way of life. So, you know, whatever is held dear as being a national identity, then there's a, and if that is felt to be threatened,
that's what Trump tapped into the most.
Yeah. So, but he trumped into both of those, nationalism and populism.
Fear.
Yeah. He definitely tapped into the nationalism. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And
And it's interesting that, again, this is, I mean, people are going to probably from both sides of the equation are going to complain about this, this, if they, you know, listen to it, but I'm just trying to take it from a very neutral, observational, factual analysis. And the Republican Party in the 90s was very much about globalization, you know, because the Republican Party was all about reducing regulation, which is still somewhat the position. And so part of that would be to allow the free market economy to determine everything, which including not having any discrimination or not limiting having any regulations for people who wanted to take stuff offshore. So globalization, dropping all trade barriers, dropping regulations. So trade barriers are nothing more than, you know, tariffs are nothing more than regulations. So if you're actually for, you know, reduced regulations, it would follow that you would be for reduced tariffs and reductions and just let the whole market, let the capitalistic, the Adam Smith, the invisible hand of competition and capitalism to determine that and let that loose on a global basis. And for better or worse. Now, Ross Perot said, you know, that giant sucking sound you hear is jobs being siphoned off to Mexico. And there was some truth, you know, to that in reality, I feel, that actually somewhat did happen. But it's a complicated equation. Did it raise the fortunes of the economy in general? And what aspects of the economy did it raise? And this article that I read was saying that the ones who were served the most were overserved by the policies of the 90s, which wasn't just the Republicans. Clinton era, too, was all about globalization. It was a common, both parties, it was unified that both parties wanted to drop all tariffs and have a free market and that eliminate all tariffs and just let the free market. I remember there was a lot of, you know, trying to beat down tariffs. That was something for decades. Make the market free because we can compete. We want to compete. Well, the people that were served were, again, somewhat of elite. The college educated, the Ivy League educated, you know, and the worker, the blue collar person, was kind of underserved by that because their jobs were taken away.
Sure.
And so those are the ones who were underserved by those policies are the ones who are now being paid attention to by the Republican Party today. And Trump tapped into that because that was a lot of anger, a lot of not just economic, social, and a way of life that was felt to have been no longer there. And so a lot of angst. So that is now where I think the Republican Party has moved to. And there, some of them could be college educated, but they're not Ivy League. They're like the state college, and they maybe work at a small startup. This is in the article. It was very well put together the way they were. Actually, it was a transcript from three people on a podcast that were discussing these things that are deep think tank people and intellectuals about describing that. And they were populists and conservatives themselves. I mean, they were not doing it from a liberal perspective. They were trying to define what was happening and what was going on and how the Republican Party, you know, Reagan would not recognize today's Republican Party. It's radically different. Not saying better or worse, it's just different, you know. So yeah. The free trade is gone. The protect, you know, now, you know, tariffs are really the opposite of free trade. That's really more protectionism and talking about having forces that try to bring jobs back. And that may be a good thing. I mean, maybe who's saying that the pendulum always swings, right? Who's saying that free markets didn't work for some aspects of the economy?
Well, one thing that's not discussed enough is because of some of those policies in the 90s that some of the more elitist people that had money to start businesses, especially in like Southeast Asia and stuff, that, you know, it was almost standard business practice for a lot of those businessmen and business entities to acquire the land for the housing for the employees at the same time. So when you have employees that are making, you know, $15 a week or whatever, like what was going on in Thailand and some of those places in the 90s, and you're making money off the housing, it's, where's the line of, I mean, where, when is that indentured servitude?
Yeah.
From a morality perspective, you know what I mean? Most Americans don't think about it or even aware of it, but that pendulum has swung back so far. And you've made a great point before with the, kind of the nationalist standpoint that so many Americans in general, and especially Trump supporters, seem to have of, you know, build the wall, get rid of the immigrants, let's send them back to Mexico kind of thing or whatever, of how, I mean, our economy would collapse if we did not, without immigration and without those people in the workforce. It's just like a business running out of cash flow, man. You know, most businesses fail because, not because it wasn't a great idea, they just moved too fast and ran out of cash to pay the bills for a month. And next thing you know, the doors are closed. And you made a wonderful point before that that could happen to our economy. If we try to, you know, really come down on immigration, and you have hundreds of thousands of workers leave our economy at the same time,
it would be catastrophic for, I mean, there'd have to be some adjustment, but it would be an impact. It would have to, in order for it to work, and to, it would have to be phased in, you know, not in order for it to be a shock to the system, there would have to be some sort of a phasing in of it, you know, a sequencing of it or something like that. But for right now, I mean, you were talking to a guy recently in Madison, an immigrant that says, yeah, I do a lot of roofing because a lot of Americans don't want to do roofing.
No,
it's a hard job.
He's absolutely right.
You know,
it's not a generalization. It just, you know, I'm in that world of construction, and it's not a generalization. It's just a fact.
Yeah.
That most people that came up in the States, most of the time you say, hey, we're going to get up and shingle this roof. No, I'm not going to do that. I'll work at a factory. I'll get a job sitting down somewhere, where, you know, a lot of the immigrants, they're all about it. They're hungrier. And to me, it's like, what's more American? You know, who's more of the typical American, like the guy that's ready to jump up on the roof and carry the shingles up there and shingle it, or the guy that says, I'm not going to do that because I don't have to work that hard? To me, I mean, those Mexican guys that I know that roof houses, I mean, they're like the quintessential Americans. Come here for a better chance, you know, bust your butt, work hard, all about family and stuff. And I mean, I know this sounds like, these are all sound like generalizations, but this is just my life experience from here in Madison. And it's just, it perplexed me for 4 years to listen to that sentiment over and over and over and over and over of like, send them back, build the wall. We got to get these immigrants out of here because they're breaking our country's back because they cost us so much money with healthcare. And these people aren't even looking at where the spending actually goes. It's such a small portion of.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you can do studies all day long on do they contribute more to the economy than they take out? And I think it's pretty clear that they contribute more, but they're illegal. Okay, so you want to be, you know, that point of saying that they are here illegally, not all of them, not all the immigrants, but Let's talk specifically about illegal immigrants. Yeah, they're lawbreakers. I mean, if you want to take that side of the position, and why should they be allowed to? I do understand that point. Why should they be allowed to break the law? And so that there is a point there. You know, I can't deny that there is a point there. They've broken the law. Perhaps they should be sent back, and or something, you know, don't allow to continue. So, but the number one way to stop that, you could stop that in a second, but no president's ever going to do it. Donald Trump didn't do it, and Biden's not going to do it, is you clamp down on the demand. You clamp down on the employers. Mm-hmm. And that'll dry up, you know. If you really want to get rid of, you know, it's just like drug trade. I mean, not to equate immigrants and drug, but illicit drugs. If you could stop the demand, it would stop coming.
Sure.
They couldn't sell it, you know. And so if you could stop the demand, if people would say, I'm not hiring, you got to show me your papers or I'm not hiring you. They couldn't have gainful employment, and they would, you know, telex back or phone back or however they do to their cousin thinking about coming, man, can't get a job here. It's worse than Mexico. We better go back to Mexico this week and work there or wherever they're from. Not all of Mexico. A lot of them are from other countries. A lot of them are other Latin American countries, not just Mexico. So they come up through Mexico. So, you know, there's that point, you know, they're illegal aliens. So,
but
you can't, you know, that's a valid point. That you can't say that is not true.
No, that's 100% true. But you and I both know that's not what it was about. he found a soft spot and gave a lot of his base an enemy. And he found a soft spot.
Donald Trump, yeah.
He pushed right through that.
That's what politics is. It's all about trying to find a soft spot. And Donald Trump did it. Was the best probably in my life.
Yeah. I mean,
masterful at engaging. I mean, I've never seen in my lifetime, I've never seen a zealous support for a leader like there is for Donald Trump. I mean, it's never seen that in my lifetime. I mean, that he's given credit for that at finding a way. I mean, there was a book I read called Primal Branding. And he is a primal brand. I mean, primal branding has 7 points, and it's been a while since I read the book. So you got to have a mantra, which is make America great again. You've got icons, the red hats. You know, you've got your leader. You've got I can't remember all the different things. I mean, it's the perfect example of a primal brand, and it's very well done. Whether completely by design or somewhat by accident, I'm not sure.
Nah, it's by design. It's a business. He ran it like a business, and he ran it masterfully.
Masterful. The best politician in my lifetime as far as creating that engaged. I mean, no matter what he does, there is nothing, you know, he did say, and there's no denying that he said it because there's recordings of it. You know, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose any voters. So he knew what he was doing. He created, and so that's what every politician would want, is having a following that would never never turn away from them, no matter what they would do. It's very, very masterful. So, you know, time will tell. I mean, the thing about it is, I mean, he's probably going to try to run again in 2024, and but what will happen between now and then? He's trying to flex his influence in the 2022 elections by primarying anyone who voted against or voted to impeach him or voted against certifying voted for certifying the results of Biden's win. And so he's going to try to penalize, and how much power will he have? And now there's, I think, how many, 5 Republican senators who have said they're not going to rerun. Is it 5? There's a bunch of them that are announcing their retirements. It's like right and left. They're saying, I had enough of this. I'm not going to. And so that opens up, you know, the primaries are going to be crazy in those states.
Yeah.
Missouri is one, I think. and is Ohio another one? Senators, traditionally red states, but you know, look what happened in Georgia. You know, so Georgia took the Democrats took both senators. So it's going to be interesting 2022 and a 2024. It's going to be interesting.
I think empathy is what swayed the whole thing. This would be an unpopular thing to say in front of a lot of people, but this is just my lens, how I viewed this thing as it, seeing it in real time as it went down. He pushed so hard on that soft spot of creating an enemy for much of his base, which is one of the biggest reasons why the majority of minorities were so against him, because they saw it for what it was and they felt it for what it was. And I did as well, because I'm a empathetic person, you know? And so I think it was the in-between people. There's a lot of people that kind of helped get him in there that saw what a business it really was, and that he was willing to do whatever at all costs.
Well, I'm not quite there. I mean, he did increase his vote totals. He got how many more million votes? The turnout was unbelievable. Probably the best turnout we've had maybe ever. That's why.
That's great.
Lost. Yeah, it's great. We want everybody voting, you know. So
that's a win. That's a win for the country.
Yeah. But I personally feel that what hurt the Democrats, that they didn't get, I mean, there were a lot of, he increased his percentage of Hispanics, which surprisingly, Trump did. He did increase. So, you know, Hispanics are by temperament and by typically conservative. They're very family oriented, and they would typically be Republicans. They're very conservative. There are a lot of them faith is very important to them. These are typical Republican strong points in the past. So they would traditionally be Republicans anyway, I feel Hispanics would. But I feel that honestly just saying that I think that what hurt the Democrats, in my opinion, was the dialogue of defund the police. You know, the reaction to BLM, you know, that seemed awfully extreme. You know, we're not even going to have police, you know, and what that really meant. And it seemed like it meant some different for other people. It's a catchphrase. And I think that was hammered by conservative radio and conservative TV.
Sure. When you first hear it, it's like, what?
Yeah. It's one bridge too far, so to speak, or, yeah. You know, it's gone beyond the pale. So, you know, even that wasn't very smart on their side. I mean, they did win, but they did hold they won the presidency, the Senate, and the House, but just barely. You know, it couldn't have been any tighter. You know, the Senate is 50-50 with just the vice president, you know, making the difference. And the House, I mean, the Republicans picked up seats in the House. So, and they were expected to lose. So the Republicans didn't do too shabby in the election. Now, part of that is the gerrymandering. I mean, those states have been gerrymandered to death. And there's a bill that, and most of those states are, so that's why, you know, the representation, the Republicans tend to get whatever percentage of votes they get, I don't know the numbers, but they have a much higher percentage of representation because of the gerrymandering. Like if you look at the total votes in these states, because they you know what I'm talking about? They have the shape of the districts are so, there's a guy who's making jewelry that is from the shapes of some more outlandish. And it's like, if you take just the shape of it and make it into a piece of jewelry, it's like there's one of them I saw, it was really long and thin, and then there's a part that barely connects, and then it gets wider at the bottom. I mean, they're just, it's just bizarre, some of these gerrymandering. And so now there's a law that's been passed by the House, but I don't think it'll get to the Senate. But I'm talking about the U.S. House. If it passed, it would outlaw that. You would have to have a 15-panel board who would, in each state, would designate the voting districts, and it's composed of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 Independents. And if that got into law, that would radically change all that gerrymandering. And it would radically change the representation in the House, because the Senate or the Republicans would be in deep trouble. Now, that will probably not pass, because simple majority can't do it. They've got the filibuster, and they will filibuster that thing to death and not let it pass. They need 10 senators, Republican senators, to go along, and that won't happen. But it is unfortunate that is going on. Gerrymandering, it really is unethical, in my opinion. But current laws allow it, so they're doing it. And so we have a gridlocked system. And then I also read another article about going deep now, and I sent this to Fedge, who was on last time, about analyzing evangelicals. And let's see if I can find this. The title of it is called "The Wasting of the Evangelical Mind." Now, I'm a Christian. I'm a born again Christian, and my faith is very important to me, and I identify as the evangelical. But this article, it talks about the general aspect of the percentage of what the evangelicals feel. A recent survey conducted by the American Enterprise Institute found that more than a quarter of white evangelicals believe that Donald Trump has been secretly battling a group of child sex traffickers that include prominent Democrats and Hollywood elites. That's a core tenet of the QAnon conspiracy theory. The data suggests that a faith-based reality divide emerging within the Republican Party. Nearly 3/4 of white evangelical Republicans believe widespread voter fraud took place in the 2020 election, compared with 54% of non-evangelicals. So 75% of evangelicals believe that there was widespread voter fraud, and only 54% of non-evangelicals, Republicans, both being Republicans. 60% of white evangelical Republicans believe that Antifa, the anti-fascist group, was mostly responsible for the violence in the Capitol riot, compared with 42% of non-evangelical Republicans. Other surveys have found that white evangelicals are much more skeptical of the COVID-19 vaccine, are less likely than other Americans to get it, potentially jeopardizing the country's recovery from the pandemic. And then this article goes on to say, how did the church in America, particularly the white Protestant evangelical manifestation, end up here? And it talks about how, that in anti-intellectualism seems to be kind of one of the main forces in today's evangelicalism, but it always wasn't the case. Back in New England days, in colonial New England days, the pastor of the church, this Puritan era, the pastor of the church was expected to be the most educated and the most intellectual individual in the entire community. He was looked upon to be extremely intellectual. In fact, all the Ivy League colleges, I think all of them, maybe an exception, were started as Christian colleges, Christian institutes of learning, Harvard, Princeton, etc. They were all started as Christian colleges. They're far from that now, obviously, but the principle of Christian and intellectualism was a tradition. It was a thing. I mean, look at C.S. Lewis, 20th century, Reinhold Niebuhr, probably mispronounced his name, enjoyed popular acclaim as Christian public intellectuals, T.S. Eliot and W.H. Auden are among the writers whose theologically orthodox Christianity served as a focal point of their art. So, but evangelicalism, this article says, has come to be defined by evangelicalism in America has come to be defined by anti-intellectualism. The style of most popular and influential pastors tend to correlate with shallowness. Charisma trumps expertise. Scientific authority is often viewed with suspicion. So it is a little surprise that American evangelicals have become vulnerable to demagoguery and misinformation. So that's another trend that concerns me greatly.
Me too. There's a general, it's not just with evangelicals, it's just in general.
An anti-intellectualism.
Yes.
And that will be the downfall of our country because we were once at the forefront. I mean, one of the things that we did were, you know, we were the first country in the world, if my understanding is correct, that had universal education up to eighth grade, you know, and then high school.
Oh, education.
Education was the way, and we led the way with having a higher educated populace than any other country. And that's a joke today. I mean, you take any European country or Singapore as an example. Singapore always is at the top.
They're crushing it.
They're crushing it as far as their educational achievement. And now there's a really undercurrent that, you know, you don't have to go to college. I mean, college isn't the answer. I mean, in today's college is kind of antiquated as well. And now Google has come out with a 6-month course that if you take it, you can come and work for them and they will pay you as if you had a college, 4-year college degree. So, you know, the world is changing and I'm not sure that the universities are keeping up. So that is open to question. I don't deny that, but to throw out all of intellectualism, with which is not an uncommon viewpoint, is a very concerning thing to me and to the future of our country. And to disregard people who've spent their entire life and career studying something and then having some upstart that doesn't know anything about it, challenging them and people going along with the upstart. Scientific method is still valid. And anyway.
It's fascinating stuff, man. It's a unique time to be alive and just to see how much has changed just in the last 3 or 4 years.
Right, right.
It's fascinating. Where are we going to be in another 3 or 4?
I know it. You know, so.
Maybe in another 8, we get a system that just hones in on that and focuses on education.
Well, there's a lot of things about our country that. Jeff, I didn't see your comments. I am so sorry, sir. How many minutes long ago was that? 7:30? Wow. Oh, just a few minutes ago. Okay. You're in college, Jeff said, and then he said Presbyterian. Thank you, Jeff. Glad you're on here. What was I saying? I lost my train.
I can't see the comments.
You can't? Here. Okay, I'll put it up here. Here's Jeff. You're in college, Jeff Boyd. Beautiful picture of Jeff with that beard.
Hey, look good, man.
That beard is shaved there. What is that, an older picture or what the heck, man?
Jeff looks like a movie star, dude.
He does there. He's got everything. Look, he's got the hair styled and woo.
You, baby.
Presbyterian. Yeah, I mean, those are some of the thoughts on my mind recently. I love my country, and yeah. I hate to see some of the infighting that we have. We can't get anything accomplished, and everything is so divided and so extreme, and nothing, you know. I saw something the other day on Quora that really kind of surprised me. I mean, there, whatever angle, signed autograph. Jeff will sign your, is that what you're saying? You will sign an autograph. You know, whatever the, whatever one side, one extreme is doing, the other side will twist it another way. And I saw something on Quora. They were talking about how now a lot of these brands, like Aunt Jemima Pancakes, or is it syrup? Maybe it's syrup. Maple syrup, was it syrup? Yeah, Aunt Jemima. It was the bottle shaped like a matronly woman. There's no longer any Aunt Jemima. And the, this argument was saying that the racist libs are taking all minority representation out of they're racist because they're removing all minority representations in branding, and now it's only white representation. Aunt Jemima is actually a caricature. It was from the guy who invented it saw it at a vaudeville show. They were wearing blackface and they were making fun of the prototypical mama or mom, or whatever you call them. Like in Gone with the Wind, the matronly woman that's in the kitchen and is, you know,
Mammy.
Yeah. Just a prototypical mammy. And it was, you know, exemplifying that. And that is really demeaning. That is not a way of exonerating, or not exonerating, but elevating African-American people. So I can understand why it was removed. And they did have a person represented. There was a picture of a woman on there and her last name was Green. And this article was saying that, well, there was an actual Aunt Jemima and they paid her. And well, they actually came up with the name Aunt Jemima, which the guy saw it at a blackface vaudeville show. And then they looked for a black woman that they could pay to be on and represent Aunt Jemima and have, so they could have a black face. And, you know, it was probably a good paying job for her. So she took the job. And so the people were representing that, you know, it was an actual person, but the whole concept of it was that it was demeaning. It was diminishing the, you know, it was a caricature. You know, so, I don't know, Redskins football, the Nashville football team. I don't know. I mean, was that, I read some articles that that wasn't some African or not African, some Native Americans were not offended by that. I'm not 100% sure if that was going a bridge too far than that point. What's your take on that? I mean,
it's a rub, man. It's a rub. There's so much healing that needs to happen in our country, and healing usually happens through humor and bringing things up. It's such a rub that I don't know. I don't know how it gets better. You know, I really don't. Where's the line? Who am I to say, man?
I mean, it's not, you know, politically correct to describe people by the color of their skin. You know, you don't describe Asians by being yellow. You don't describe, you don't describe Indians, you know, by being red. I mean, that's considered.
I think that I would
black though. We still say. I mean,
I still say black all the time, but it has nothing to do with not being politically correct. I'm just an inherently lazy human being.
It takes longer to say African American.
A lot of syllables, man. It's nothing about you know, me feeling a certain way. It's if I can say something with one syllable, I'm gonna. You know what I'm saying? Unless I get beat up.
I'd rather say white than Caucasian.
Yeah, right. White. I would call white people white. You know, it just is what it is, man. People are inherently lazy.
Well, I want to see. I mean, this is not an original idea, but I want to see I think I saw this as in a league where some Native Americans wanted to see all the mascots be derogatory names for white people, like Cracker, right. The Crackers, and the I can't even think of it.
My people already got one. Notre Dame, baby.
The Fighting Irish. There you go. Nobody's offended by that. Nobody's offended by that.
Think it's great.
So what was the Redskins too far? Well, I mean, that one I won't weigh in. I mean, I don't know, but I do strongly believe, in my opinion, that Aunt Jemima was derogatory.
Yeah, that was too far. Bad.
So
it's good that people are checking the line, man. I mean, it needs to be revisited ever so often.
And then Land O'Lakes. I don't know. Land O'Lakes was a brand from upper Midwest, Minnesota. You know, it had a beautiful young Indian maiden sitting on the ground with her legs squat. I mean, she was sitting with her legs crossed and her arms out or something like that. And it was supposed to be, close to the land, purity, I guess. She wasn't named, but I'm wondering if they've gotten rid of that. That maybe have gotten in the crossfires as well.
Yeah.
Appropriating Native American imagery for a brand. I'm not sure. I don't feel strongly either way on that one. I do feel about Jemima, though. Aunt Jemima, I feel, was racist and derogatory. But, I mean, the way it was twisted back, they were saying that the people removing it are racist because they're removing minority representation in logos. No, there are no more minority representation logos. You got rid of that. So it's only white representation. I mean, guess what are some of what, I mean, there's a whole bunch of, like Colonel Sanders, and that's a white guy. And, if somebody founded the company, there's a whole bunch of others. I can't think of them right now, but, we've been going over 40 minutes. What else you got to say?
Good talk. Interesting stuff.
Well, our movie star is apparently gone, so we'll have to have him on again soon.
Hey, he looks great, man.
All right.
Good to see you, man.
Good to see you. See you next time. Peace.